So Joshua chapter 7. Well, in fact, the passage set for us this morning is chapter 7 and the bulk of chapter 8. But in fact, we're just going to look at chapter 7 and refer to chapter 8. Joshua chapter 7, Achan's sin. Well, let's start with verse 27 of chapter 6. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame spread throughout the land. But the Israelites acted unfaithfully in regard to the devoted things. Achan, son of Carmi, the son of Zimri, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, took some of them. So the Lord's anger burned against Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth-Aven to the east of Bethel, and told them, "Go up and spy out the region." So the men went up and spied out Ai. When they returned to Joshua, they said, "Not all the people will have to go up against Ai. Send 2,000 or 3,000 men to take it, and do not weary all the people, for only a few men are there." So about 3,000 men went up. But they were routed by the men of Ai, who killed about 36 of them. They chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarries, and struck them down on the slopes. At this, the hearts of the people melted and became like water. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell face down to the ground before the ark of the Lord, remaining there till evening. The elders of Israel did the same and sprinkled dust on their heads. And Joshua said, "Ah, sovereign Lord, why did you ever bring this people across the Jordan to deliver us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we'd been content to stay on the other side of the Jordan. Oh Lord, what can I say now that Israel's been routed by its enemies? The Canaanites and the other people of the country will hear about this, and they will surround us and wipe out your name from the earth. What then will you do for your own great name?" The Lord said to Joshua, "Stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They have violated my covenant which I commanded them to keep. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen. They have lied. They have put them with their own possessions. That is why the Israelites cannot stand against their enemies. They turn their backs and run because they have been made liable to destruction. I will not be with you any more unless you destroy whatever among you is devoted to destruction. Go, consecrate the people. Tell them, 'Consecrate yourselves in preparation for tomorrow. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says: that which is devoted is among you, O Israel. You cannot stand against your enemies until you remove it. In the morning, present yourselves tribe by tribe. The tribe that the Lord takes shall come forward clan by clan. The clan that the Lord takes shall come forward family by family. And the family that the Lord takes shall come forward man by man. He who is caught with the devoted things shall be destroyed by fire, along with all that belongs to him. He has violated the covenant of the Lord and has done a disgraceful thing in Israel." Early the next morning, Joshua had Israel come forward by tribes, and Judah was taken. The clans of Judah came forward, and he took the Zerahites. He had the clan of the Zerahites come forward by families, and Zimri was taken. Joshua had his family come forward man by man, and Achan, son of Carmi, the son of Zimri, the son of Zerah, of the tribe of Judah, was taken. And Joshua said to Achan, "My son, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give him the praise. Tell me what you have done. Do not hide it from me." Achan replied, "It's true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I've done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They're hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath." So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and there it was, hidden in his tent with the silver underneath. They took the things from the tent, brought them to Joshua and all the Israelites, and spread them out before the Lord. And Joshua, together with all Israel, took Achan, son of Zerah, the silver, the robe, the gold wedge, his sons and daughters, his cattle, donkeys and sheep, his tent, and all that he had, to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, "Why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble on you today." Then all Israel stoned him. And after they'd stoned the rest, they burned them. Over Achan they heaped up a large pile of rocks, which remains to this day. And the Lord turned from his fierce anger. Therefore that place has been called the Valley of Achor ever since. And chapter 8 sees Ai destroyed according to plan A. Well, why is it that one day things are going well with God? Mountaintop experience, soaring like an eagle. You're in tune with God. You're looking for opportunities to witness. Your halo is varnished. You're a top Christian bloke. And the next day, those peaks become troughs. The eagle becomes a beagle and can't be found on the planet's surface. Witnessing? Well, you feel like auditioning for "I'm a Christian, get me out of here." And your halo? Well, it's tarnished and not varnished. Why is that? Think of it another way. You're playing for Israel United. And by some miracle, you've just been promoted to the Transjordan Promised Land Premier League. Your first fixture is away to Jericho City. On paper, you've got no chance. But actually, it was a walkover. Well, more of a walk round and a fall over. But you know what I mean. You've got a new manager, Joshua, part of Joshua's sky blue army. You've got a new song, "You'll Never Walk Alone." How fitting. Fact is, you've never had it so good. You're top of the league. And this week, you're scheduled to play Lonely AI. Hey. Some small town team, so small, nobody knows how to pronounce their name. But shock, horror, you lose the first leg. Actually, some lose more than their first leg. And the final score, body count, is 36-0. You can't believe it. What's gone wrong? Joshua, the manager's gone to see him upstairs. The chairman is going to be on the carpet over this one. So what did go wrong? Why are there these ups and downs in the Christian life? Why is it that defeat so often follows a victory, that a low so often follows a high? Well, the passage, I think, shows up three things. And the big one, of course, is Achan's sin. That's the title in our Bible. And we'll come to that in a moment. But there's a couple of other interesting things I think it's worth pointing out first. Both of them really follow on one from the other. And the first thing I think it's worth pointing out is self-confidence. It's perhaps one of the reasons why they lost this battle. Well, you can't really blame them, can you? Jerusalem's in ruins. Just by walking, shouting, blowing trumpets, Jericho, did I say Jerusalem? Jericho has been laid to waste. Their confidence must have been sky high. And they send out two spies to Ai. And they report back, and it's easy peasy. Let's not trouble everyone. There's just 3,000. Just a few men there. Just 3,000 of our men will do. So Joshua sends out 3,000 men. And they're routed and chased back to camp, and 36 are dead. And verse 5b has it graphically, doesn't it? chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarries, struck them down on the slopes. But this, the hearts of the people melted and became like water. So it is that a defeat comes after a victory, a low after a high. The self-confidence and complacency are natural, aren't they? I'm just keep the football analogy going, sorry girls, but I mean in midweek this week, and indeed yesterday, you know, Tottenham in midweek, 3-0 up, half time. You think, doddle. And you can imagine the manager speaking, can't you? Now, come on, boys, I know we're 3-0 up, but keep it tight. Keep doing the same things. Let's keep it going. But the players go out and they just think, you know, this is so easy. This is going to be a walkover. And they lost 4-3. Joshua was saying, he's not saying this, is he? But you can imagine the people thinking, you know, look what we did to Jericho. Nothing can stand in our way now. But this is forgetting something. That it wasn't them who gained the victory. It was the Lord. At Jericho, it was him who went before the people. The battle was his. The victory was at his hand. And here in this chapter, chapter 7, there's no mention of the Ark of the Covenant going before the army. They went in their own strength, not in the Lord's strength. They went in their own understanding and not the Lord's understanding. And they learned the lesson the hard way. And it's true for us sometimes too, isn't it? Sometimes we think, you know, we did so well yesterday, whatever it was, you know, witnessing or, you know, the church community and change or whatever it is. Let's not bother the Lord today. We'll give him a day off. You know what? He doesn't need to be looking after me today. He's got more important things to do than watch over me. And, you know, this will be okay. And it's then that we fall. Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him. And he will make straight your paths. So self-confidence, complacency. And out of that, the second point really, along with self-confidence comes the potential for a lack of prayer. You got a big river to cross? Well, before you go, talk to God. Get his instructions. Consecrate yourselves. That's what happened in chapter 3. They crossed the river. Got a big walled city to defeat? Well, before you go, spend a few months circumcising the nation and healing. Celebrating the Passover. Talking to the Lord's messenger. Finding out his way of defeating the city, which wouldn't have been your way. And that's what happened in chapter 5 and chapter 6. Got some tricky problems ahead? Got some big decisions to make? How about just a normal everyday life with its ups and downs and its rivers and cities and relationships and tensions? Talk to God. Pray. Got a tiny town like Ai to rout? What should Joshua have done? Pray, did I hear you say? And did he? No, did I hear you reply? There's no mention of prayer here. Just defeat. And you see, it makes no difference. You can be the commander of the people of Israel, or you can be a housewife or a house husband. You can be a full-time elder of Salford Evangelical Church, or you can be the Archbishop of Canterbury. You can be the MD of a large firm, or you can be anywhere in between in the strata of society. If you're human and you're alive, then you need to pray. Or else, risk defeat. You know the old poem, don't you, The Difference? I got up early one morning and rushed right into the day. I had so much to accomplish, but I didn't take time to pray. Problems just tumbled about me, and heavier came each task. Why doesn't God help me? I wondered. He answered, "You didn't ask." I wanted to see joy and beauty, but the day toiled on, grey and bleak. I wondered why God didn't show me. He said, "But you didn't seek." I tried to come into God's presence. I used all my keys in the lock. And God gently and lovingly chided, "My child, you didn't knock." I woke up early this morning and paused before entering the day. I had so much to accomplish, but I had to take time to pray. Self-confidence, lack of prayer. The third and biggest reason for this defeat, and so often the case with us, is sin. Whilst the first two reasons, I guess, are acts of omission, neglecting to trust God, neglecting to pray, this last one is very much an act of commission. Disobedience, in fact. In Church of England speak, those of you who've been there in the past, the first two are in the category of leaving undone the things that we ought to have done. And this last one is doing those things that we ought not to have done. What is the sin? Well, we find out, in fact, before Joshua does, because the narrator of the story sets it out right there in verse 1. The Israelites acted unfaithfully in regard to the devoted things. What's all that about? If you look at the footnote in the NIV, you'll see that the Hebrew term for devoted things refers to the irrevocable giving over of things or persons to the Lord, often by totally destroying them. And you'll see it throughout these verses and in previous chapters as well. Now this practice is first found in Leviticus chapter 27. There's a distinction made there between dedicating something to the Lord and devoting something to the Lord. You could dedicate something to the Lord, an animal or an object or yourself or your children, and you retained that thing that you dedicated to the Lord, but you used it to His glory, or it was used in His service. But when you devoted something to the Lord, that object or animal was offered exclusively to the Lord and was given over to Him completely. And so animals, objects that could be destroyed, were destroyed, because in that way they were seen to be given over to the Lord. If they couldn't be destroyed, something that was gold or precious metal, then they'd be given to the treasury. You couldn't have them, you couldn't use them. They were given over, devoted to the Lord. They were made holy to God, because God is holy. And that was true for all walks of life. And it came to have a particular meaning at times like this, when the nation were in battle, when they were fighting in the name of the Lord, fighting for His honour and His glory. And so all the plunder, and that includes all the animals and all the people, who, if they weren't given over to the Lord, would become slaves, all those things were devoted to God, were given over to God. And in this way, in doing this, there would be no distractions. The battle would be fought for the right reasons, for the glory of God and for the honour of His name, rather than with one eye on all the slaves you're going to bring home with you and all the booty you're going to bring home with you. All the flocks that could be yours. And there's an added dimension as well at this time. Because the people of God have been given the promised land. And they're to be a model people who live their lives under the guidance and with the presence of the Lord of all. And they're to serve Him and serve Him only. And show to all the people around the difference that this holy God can make in their lives. And the present inhabitants of the land, well, they worship false gods. And they keep immoral practices. And these things must be cleansed and purged, or else the people of God may be tainted and tempted and distracted. So it was that last week we read in chapter 6 and verse 17, just before they go and lay siege to Jericho. Chapter 6, verse 17, Joshua says, "The city and all that is in it are to be devoted to the Lord." Now all the people would have known what that meant, that nothing was to be theirs after they'd laid waste to it. "Only Rahab the prostitute and all her with her in her house shall be spared, because she hid the spies we sent. But keep away from the devoted things, so that you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them." That might seem strange to us, but the people then knew exactly what this was all about. What was required of them, what was demanded of them by a holy God, and what would happen if they didn't. And it's this command that Achan breaks. And so the Lord's anger is kindled. And in verse 1 we read, "The Lord's anger burned against Israel." In the Hebrew, I've said this before, it actually says his nose burns. Just so graphic, isn't it? Do you sense his anger? This nose burning? Now the story itself doesn't need much explanation, does it? Following defeat, then Joshua prays. And in verse 6 and a few verses following, in his prayer he blames God. "Why did you bring us here if you're going to lead us into defeat? What are you going to do now for the glory of your name?" He tries to shame God into coming good for them again. But the Lord's having none of it, is he? And in verses 10 to 12, he says, "Stand up, this isn't the time to pray." He comes straight to the point, he pulls no punches, and explains what has gone wrong. "You've been defeated because you're disobedient. And therefore you are liable to destruction. And I will not go with you unless this is sorted out." This is serious business. Verses 13 to 19, the process by which Achan is singled out. Verses 20 to 21, Achan's admission of what he's done. And verses 22 to 26, the cleansing and purging of Achan and all that belong to him. The putting right of what was wrong by stoning and burning of Achan and his family and all that he owned. And in chapter 8 then you go on to see that Israel reverses that first leg defeat and goes on to win. And this slaughter, this purging, this practice of devoted things is alien, isn't it, to our sensitized 21st century ears. And for many people here, we have a big theological difficulty. You must have heard it. You may even think it. I can't be dealing with a God of wrath who demands murder and punishment. I'd rather have the New Testament God, a God of love and mercy and grace, a God who's a friend rather than a judge, a God who's fatherlike rather than fearsome. But it won't do. For a start, it's not true. Because the Old Testament depicts God as a God of love first and foremost. Exodus chapter 34, verse 6 has these verses which are repeated throughout the Old Testament and into the New Testament of a God who is gracious and compassionate, who is slow to anger, who is abounding in love. You know the words, don't you? They're there throughout Scripture, but they start there in the Old Testament. And not only that, the New Testament knows God as judge. A God whose wrath is aroused by the sin in the world. Just read the first chapter of Romans. Just as his love is shown to that same world. You see, the whole Bible shows us the whole character of God. And passages like these, where his wrath and his judgment are shown, actually serve to illuminate all the more what happened at Calvary. You see, this passage tells us about the holiness of God. You see, God is different to you and me. That's what being holy means. It means he's set apart because he's different. He is the only God. He is ageless. He is eternal. He's the creator of all things. He's all powerful. He's all knowing. He's everywhere present. These are the things that make him holy, different, set apart. And one more thing, something that's usually associated with holiness. He's pure, clean, untainted, chaste, totally without sin or fault or blemish. Wouldn't that be in your definition of God? Would we worship someone who is anything less than pure and perfect and holy? I don't think so. So you see, we get a picture of a holy God. Now ask yourself, what should such a God's reaction to sin be? Just a shrug of the shoulders? Oh well, it doesn't matter. Well, again, I don't think so. You see, sin has spoiled the beauty of God's creation. It's wrecked the perfection of his creation. Sin has caused this world to be fallen and imperfect. And sin has made rotten the apple of God's eye, the crown of his creation, you and me. Sin is a barrier between him and us. It wrecks our relationship. Sin has ruined everything. And it's insidious, isn't it, sin? Did you notice it was Achan's sin? But actually, it's in that first verse that the Israelites acted unfaithfully in regard to the devoted things. And when God's unpacking it all to Israel, it's Israel has sinned, verse 11. They have violated my covenant which I commanded them. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen. They have lied. They have put them with their own possessions. Not just Achan. No man is an island, somebody said. You can't sin and it not affect other people. That's the nature of sin. Just as in Adam, he sinned. So actually, all have sinned. Begin to build up this picture. God is so holy and so pure, he can't tolerate sin near him. Sin has no place, no right even to be in the same place before a holy God. So when there's sin around before this holy God, two things happen. First thing is that God gets angry, and rightly so. You see, his anger isn't like ours. He's not angry because he's a petulant person, or because he's inconsistent, or because he's moody, or because the mood takes him. He's not angry for any or no reason. God's anger is a righteous anger, and it's roused by injustice. And sin has spoiled everything he loves. And it takes his loved ones away from him. No wonder he's angry. And no wonder this second thing happens then. Because sin, for God, sin must be dealt with. It must be purged if things are to get back the way they should be. Hence, Achan's plight. and Achan's punishment. Because without his removal, the Lord couldn't go with his people on into the land. But with his removal, they were able to go on, it's chapter 8, and destroy Ai. You see, this is our God, folks. This is the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And now, he's holy and pure. He hates sin and has to do something about it. And actually, this is human nature, isn't it, as well, in all its glory. In the Old Testament, in the New Testament, and now. Achan's sin, in his own words, verse 20 and 21, he saw, he coveted, and he took. He was tempted. He gave into it. And which of us can say that we haven't? And you know, in doing these things, Achan was in fact guilty of a greater sin. That of holding something back from the Lord. He kept for himself that which should have gone to God for his glory. And which of us can say that we've never done that either? Never held back our time, our talents, our money, our lives? So, same God, holy and pure. Same human nature, sinful and disobedient. Now, doesn't this mean that I deserve the same punishment as Achan? Yeah? And so, to the cross. How can we reconcile a God of wrath and a God of love? How can we reconcile a God of judgment with a God of mercy? How can we reconcile a God who hates sin but loves the sinner? Well, the answer is at the cross, where Jesus, the very Son of God, hung in our place and took the punishment that we deserved as sinners. And in so doing, he satisfies the wrath of God. And he expresses the love of God. And he shows the mercy of God. And he declares the grace of God. And he offers the pardon of God to all who in faith come before Christ, acknowledge their sins, accept his forgiveness, and enter into relationship with this God as a child to a father. Amazing. Well, the title this morning is Sin and Its Consequences. One man sinned, Israel was guilty, and they were defeated in battle. And folks, we need to be aware that our sins have consequences. And, you know, what we do, even in private, can affect others and can affect the church. And we asked why there were lows following highs and why there were failures following victories. And we said there are three possible causes, as shown here. Self-confidence, not trusting in God, a lack of prayer, and also disobedience. But I hope over all of this we've seen what God has done in Christ. To offer forgiveness for our sins. To promise a new life. Lived in relationship with him. Thanks be to God for his word.